Oi. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Can't go without my script here. Good afternoon, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Hagel. Left is Judge Lance. We're here today in the matter of Mark Littman, docket number 071617. Would counsel for the parties please note their appearance for the record?
I'm Mark Littman for appellant.
Please stand when you talk.
Mark Littman for appellant.
Thank you.
Ken Walsh with Ed Cassidy for the secretary, Your Honor.
All right. With Ed Ken, I'm sorry. Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yeah, about 7 minutes.
7 minutes you have. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. USC 5904C3A provides that the secretary may order a fee reduction called for in the agreement if and only if the secretary finds that the fee is excessive and unreasonable. Thus, I think that the touchstone for any analysis or any review of a fee agreement is whether it is excessive or unreasonable. By its terms, that language sets up a presumption. The secretary only has jurisdiction and only has the ability to reduce a fee if it can be shown that the fee agreement is excessive or unreasonable. And I think that the current regulation of 38 CFR 20.609F, the former 20.609F and the current 14.636F is consistent with that language. If we look at Skates with that in mind, I think we have to first understand that Skates is not a holding for the proposition or any issues that have to do with the reasonableness of a fee. Skates decided who had proper jurisdiction to decide that question, whether the board or the regional office, and it decided that in this particular circumstance, the regional office did. I think that's reinforced by the fact that 7263 of the United States Code, Title 838, says that the CAVC has the last word or last review on any questions on the reasonableness of a fee. And I think that, again, is affirmed in the Carpenter case in the Federal Circuit. That said, I think some of the dicta in Skates is helpful, and unfortunately, some of it's confusing. Skates, one of the most important things in the Skates opinion is that it said that continued attorney representation is implied in any contingency fee agreement in the VA system.
Let me just get this straight. You presented a brief to the court that didn't mention Skates, is that correct?
The original
brief?
Yes.
You presented a supplemental that said Skates applies and should be remanded so the board could apply Skates. Is that correct?
True.
And you are now arguing to us that Skates is not applicable because it only dealt with jurisdiction except for the dicta in Skates.
Right. Right.
Why are you shifting argument?
Well, Your Honor, I'll be honest with you. It's a complicated case.
I hope you'd be honest with us.
Be candid with you that after looking at it, I've looked at it harder and I've gotten more ideas out of it. So I'm just giving my best presentation.
Is this the way you approached your client, just out of curiosity?
No.
You didn't have a shifting presentation of views on the case until the day you went to file a brief?
I don't...
Never mind. Proceed.
Anyway, Skates stated that it's implied in the contract that there should be, that there has to be attorney representation continuous throughout the case.
Would you cite to me again the site in the statute that says the secretary can reduce fees if and only if...
It says It's 5904C3A.
5904.
The secretary may, upon the secretary's own motion or at the request of the claimant, review a fee agreement filed pursuant to paragraph 2 and may order reduction in the fee called for in the agreement if the secretary finds that the fee is excessive or unreasonable.
Okay.
I don't have problems with the skates. Opinion as to the basic proposition that any attorney fee agreement implies continuous, that the attorney continued to provide services. And that's what we do, and we so represent it. What I have a problem with, and I think even the state's opinion had a problem with, is when it used the analysis, in this case, it didn't deal with a successive attorney, a successor attorney. You had an attorney, and then you had what I see it presumably an unpaid representative. And the policy of it, and when they cited to some civil law cases, the civil law cases aren't helpful in this context because they assume that when the first attorney is discharged, that you'll have a successor attorney. That's due to the complexity of civil litigation, also the formality of it. And so you're not going to have the abuse where you have here where a client is trying to save attorney fees. And I think in a case that the intervener cited called Fracas, they talked about a little bit about that. One of the arguments raised in that case was if you allow a client to terminate the contingency fee without any showing and terminate any contingency interest, aren't you sort of inviting abuse because he'll terminate it and then try to save the money on his own? And the court response is no, because the vast likelihood is that client is going to need another attorney to complete the case. So there's no problem. I mean, that's a self-limiting factor.
Well, Counselor, let's get to the brass tacks here. On June 7th of 2002 or thereabouts, June of 2002, Mr. Swinger wrote a letter, had it filed. You signed it and said you're hereby discharged from further responsibilities of representation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Right.
All right. You drafted the contingency fee agreement, I assume, that was signed on May 15th of 2000.
Okay.
Right. Paragraph 6 says, client may discharge attorney at any time, period. You were discharged. You had no further responsibilities. You had no further duties. Mr. Swinger didn't want you in the case. He chose not to replace you with another attorney and then proceeded on his own to get reimbursement for his claim without your assistance in any form or fashion. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. So let's talk about quantum merit. What did you do on this second claim to earn $7,000 that you're claiming?
The best way I could answer is that the most important issue was getting the service connection. And I thought that my brief was helpful in that regard. But as far as getting the extra level, I wasn't representing him. I was prevented from assisting him.
Well, are you asserting in any form or fashion that Mr. Swinger was not operating in good faith?
Yes, I don't think he was operating in good faith. Exactly, and I could go into that if you would,
Is that part of the record?
Yes.
Okay. You argued that to the board?
No, I looked at it, I didn't know.
All right. So that's the only qualifier here in paragraph 6 of the agreement that you drafted, which is to say that the client's right to discharge must be made in good faith. And if that's not before us as a matter of historical development of the case, then it seems to me that we don't have to worry about skates and we don't have to worry about a regulation. We don't even have a contract that's enforceable relative to the $7,000.
Well,
as I read this.
Well, I'm just stating what the law. The law allows him to dismiss me. Yes. I didn't say that his contractual obligations would be relieved by it. I mean, and in fact, I mean, if I may, just the reason I didn't argue, one of the reasons I didn't argue before the board is the bad faith came up in the most recent personal hearing that he requested in connection with the fees, and I think it was also in connection with the merits of the case. And I wasn't invited to that, but he represented, if we turn to page 1099 of the record, and we're talking about the March 6, 2007 personal hearing. The board decision came out, I believe, a month after that. And they start, pages 1101, Your Honors. He says, he in there where it says the veteran, he basically says that he got a lot of letters from a lot of attorneys. He just randomly grabbed one that was mine. And then I represented that, and after a while the board would remand the case. And once I found out that they remanded it, I said, well, he said he was no longer my attorney representing me because the board remanded it back. I sent a letter that's not true. I sent him a letter saying that I wouldn't continue the representation of the cases that were denied. But the letter, and he could not possibly read it, is saying that I wasn't going to continue representing him on the PTSD claim. And if he had any, in the letter, if there was any confusion, I said, please call me if you have any questions. And he didn't even bother to call. Then he says, and this is why it's not part of the record. He goes, I thought he hadn't finished anything, and so later on when he came up here for a hearing, and once I was granted and everything, and then all of a sudden he popped up back in the picture saying that, you know, he wants to be paid, and so what's the argument there? I let him know on, excuse me, Your Honors. That month on June 28th, 2002, I wrote and said, I am writing to let you know that I received your recent correspondence in which you removed me as attorney of record. Please be advised that if your award benefits in the above claim, I will insist upon my statutory and contractual right to 20% of the retroactive benefits. And so he's misrepresenting. I'm not there at the hearing. And he's misrepresenting facts, which I can't do anything about. Then, he has a friend who is assisting him on the case, and we see it at page 1102. He says, I've been following this pretty good on this. This is Mr. Counsel. And I'll just read it. For the first part of going through the courts, veterans' appeals, but what was a puzzle to me as an attorney was it was remanded back to you guys, the board, hearing to be adjudicated. They denied everything except post-traumatic stress disorder. As an attorney, I would have said, okay, Sammy, you've been denied everything except PTSD, so I'm going to put an appeal in for PTSD or post-traumatic disorder because we've got evidence to show that you got PTSD. The letter never said that I wasn't going to represent on PTSD. But instead, Mr. Littman sent him a letter saying I'm not going to take any more action. I didn't write him a letter on that. Absolutely wrong.
All right. Well, that wasn't the basis of the board decision, was it? As I understand the board decision, it denied you any additional payment beyond the first initial award of benefits because of 14.636H.
It's true, but I think it sheds a light on how we need to interpret.
I understand, but let's first understand where we're at. The board denied you because of a regulation.
Right.
That specifically said your award is based on the initial disability rating assigned.
Right. And
so
I
presume your position is that if you got a zero, you went through entire litigation up here in the court. An example, not what happened here. Entire litigation up here, full briefing, went on all the issues, sent it back, and we reversed and even gave him service connection. It went on down, and he got a 0% disability rating. In the process, he fired you after going through all the work here, that you would get 0%. And your view, as I understand it, would be that this regulation is arbitrary and capricious, inconsistent with the statute, by putting a bright line and saying that you get nothing because it's all based on the initial rating. Is that your argument?
Right, right. That was my opening brief. And that's why I didn't feel Skates was directly on point then.
So to carry that further, you would say then that because this is the same claim and not an increased rating claim that came later, but rather the same claim, that your agreement applies to across the board to everything that came about. Let's take the firing of you. Well, no, you can't take that out of this. That under these situations, when you got dismissed as his attorney, relieved as his attorney, that at that point you were entitled to 100% of what he ultimately got in any initial proceedings down below that ended up final. And in this case, I gather it's 100%, even though that isn't the board decision before us. At that time, he had 50%, I believe, the rating, disability rating. Ultimately, I understand he got 100%.
Yeah, he got 100%. Right. You're correct.
So how would your view would be you get 20% of all that? Even though he let you go, that Skates doesn't apply.
What I feel is the presumption of reasonableness should apply. If he doesn't pick up another attorney, I have no problem with Skates on the thing that if I represent him for a certain portion of the claim and he picks up another attorney and he has to share that fee with that attorney, I have no problem apportioning that, because
why do you have a problem apportioning it if he represents himself?
Because he's doing it, or presumably.
You know, first of all, Mr. Lippman, it might just be helpful to you if occasionally, just occasionally, you would throw in a Your Honor or Judge and recognize that you're in a courtroom and not out on the street somewhere.
I apologize, Your Honor. I appreciate you.
So if you would recognize that two attorneys could split the fee, I assume based on quantum merit, each of them being awarded fees based upon the work that they did, then why is it that you won't split the fee with your former client who represented himself?
Because it doesn't impinge on the statute of what's reasonable. In other words, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't want me to interrupt.
No.
Sorry, go ahead. The reasonableness, there's a presumption that a 20% fee, regardless of how many attorneys represent the veteran, is reasonable. I think that's a fair reading of the statute, and that is a reading of the regs. I think when you're talking, and so if there's just one attorney, I still think the presumption of reasonableness should apply. Now, he can rebut the presumption, but I think in order to rebut the presumption, he has to come up with more than just bald assertions. I think the Vernon case says that, and I think the Carpenter case says that.
Well, what about the portion of Skates, and you would want us now to apply Skates, that tells us that attorneys should be paid based upon the work that they do?
Right, the contribution. And I think that
that's
that,
right.
I think in context, it's hard to read Skates because it talks
okay,
about...
Well, answer this question. What work did you do to earn the first portion of the fee, which was what, this $9,000 or the $7,000?
First portion was the $9,000.
Okay. You're awarded that. There's no question about that. What work did you do to earn that?
I think most of the work was in the brief, the opening brief.
And that was filed with whom?
The court.
Okay. And remanded, I take it.
There was a remand, and then I continued. I wrote a letter to just inquiring to the BVA to move the case along.
Right. Okay.
Right. And I didn't think there was more to do.
Okay. And then at what point in time there was the attorney-client relationship severed? While it was still at the board?
Yes, on June 24, 2002.
So while it was still at the board? Okay, now what work did you do after that point in time?
After I was terminated?
Mm-hmm.
None.
And to what was done at the RO, if anything, that ultimately resulted in Mr. Swinger getting the rating that he finally got. Did Mr. Swinger present additional evidence? Did he represent himself on appeal?
Yeah, he represented himself on appeal. I think the board on the 100%, if I recall correctly, relied mostly upon evidence that already existed before I got before I was terminated.
Did you gather that evidence, or was there in the?
It was already in evidence.
Okay. So from what I'm hearing from you is that with regard to the service connection, you know, your brief certainly outlines service connection and so forth. And of course, that would be the primary issue when you were before the court, I assume. So rating wasn't briefed to the court. You know, the court wasn't concerned with rating until there's service connection. So now it goes back down to the RO. You're not providing any services. You didn't provide any additional evidence. You didn't file an appeal on his behalf, and yet you want $7,000. And it seems to me that at least the dicta in Skates would say, you know, I don't think that's really right.
But if I had done nothing, hypothetically, Your Honor, and I was there at the end, and he decided just not to discontinue it, is it any more or less unfair? I mean, I think that's the problem with Skates. I mean, Skates talks about policy and how to read a statute, and not so much about the equity. And my feeling is that if Skates is concerned about, you know, how to read the statute of reasonableness, or, you know, to make a finding of unreasonableness.
Yet you would say that if another attorney was involved, that other attorney could share the fee. I just can't,
because it's
explain
not
to me why I can't quite get.
Okay.
Why the blessing of somebody being an attorney makes any difference if you accept that proposition, which you apparently do. You know, why the appellate can't stand in his own shoes.
Your Honor, because the statute puts a limit. It's a magic threshold of 20% attorney fees. If it's more than that, then it doesn't deserve the presumption of reasonableness. So, if attorneys are sharing and you're allowing incremental fees on top of the 20%, it's offending the statute. Whereas
it's 20% total.
20% total, and it doesn't
matter
how many
attorneys. Another attorney comes in, they split it 10% and 10%, and you're happy with that.
Right.
I think the question is, now you have an attorney and a veteran, why wouldn't that same analysis work? Is it because there's a presumption that if he went out and got another attorney, you don't have a bad faith that he wanted to collect it all for himself? But if he goes out and does it himself, you might have this issue of bad faith, and maybe he needs to demonstrate something as to why he got rid of you?
Right. In other words, when you look at a case called Frakas, you don't have the institutional check. In other words, if his successor representative is unpaid.
Is this in your brief, Frakas?
No, it's in the intervener, the PVA's. It's
your former client's brief.
And you don't. In other words, you don't have that check where he is going. Where you have the abuse, where he's going to try to save himself and get out from under the contract. The hard work's done. The service connection is the service. You know, the issue of PTSD was the threshold issue was service connection. So, once the hard work's done, I don't need you anymore. You know, if you would have gotten another attorney,
and you got paid for the hard work.
I didn't get the 20%. I didn't get the 20% on the claim. And I would have been happy to continue to represent him throughout.
You got 20% on
a phase of a claim, Your Honor. Excuse me.
Well, that's right. I mean, you got 20% on the initial rating for the claim, and then to get beyond that, it required additional work.
But whose fault is that? That I didn't continue to exist. I think that's part of how you have to look at
it. Your time is up. Would you like him to answer the question?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right, your time is up. You have 7 minutes reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Again, Ken Walsh for the secretary. Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
Your Honors, the secretary respectfully submits that the plain language of statutory section 5904D2 does not preclude regulation of how to determine eligibility or perhaps reasonableness based on lack of participation in later phases of a claim. The statute leaves gaps for the secretary.
What about 5904B, C, 3A, as referred to by opposing counsel? In other words, if you have a presumption that 20% is reasonable, here's a provision that says you can reduce the fee if it's excessive or unreasonable. So if it's presumed reasonable, you're suggesting that an across-the-board regulatory provision that says we limit it here is okay and reasonable, as opposed to a case-by-case evaluation as to what is reasonable or unreasonable.
Your Honor, I would say that this particular issue blurs the line between eligibility and reasonableness.
All right, well, let me give you an example. Counsel goes up, gets a remand from the court, initial decision from the regional office is service connection, zero disability. Counsel gets nothing. Counsel is fired in between. Counsel gets nothing. The veteran appeals, it goes to the board, gets 100%. Counsel gets nothing according to this regulation.
According to this regulation, if, yes, Your Honor, the secretary
is
found.
How is that reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, again, looking at, Chevron analysis, I think this might be useful.
We'll defer. How is it reasonable? I mean, arbitrary and capricious is the standard for overturning a regulation. How is this reasonable in light of a statute that gives a presumption of 20% that says it can be taken away under these conditions to do an across-the-board, arbitrary and capricious, possibly? That's what we're arguing.
Your
provision
Honor,
that says counsel gets only what is awarded on the initial disability. Would you agree? Let me ask you another question first and come back to that one, and I'll restate it if you want me to.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you agree that this is all one claim? This is not a claim for an increased rating that came after the fact. This is all part of the claim, same claim.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Now, do I need to repeat that other question? Why is it reasonable
where
for the secretary to do an across-the-board provision that says an attorney who represents a veteran and has a 20% agreement for the amount that's ultimately paid can never get more than what's on the initial rating decision by the RO, which could be zero?
The secretary believes that the regulation is reasonable in that regard because it serves some of the roles or some of the purposes that Congress sought when it enacted the legislation. Obviously, we've seen movement by Congress on this issue, and Congress has been constantly balancing the need to protect veterans from overreach by counsel.
Okay, well, let me go back. I understand all your concepts, but I'm asking why, across the board, does it fulfill the objectives of Congress when an attorney signs up with a veteran, says, I'll represent you, has it remanded, gets the service connection awarded, gets fired by his client, and then a 0% disability rating, he appeals it to the board and 100% comes about. How is that reasonable?
Your Honor, I contend, or the secretary contends, that it's reasonable because bright line rules will promote greater predictability, greater government efficiency. Your Honor, obviously we're outside of the brief, and I'll say this with your leave, but bright line rules are frequently used by the agency. I would put up Haas as an example. And of course, whenever you have a bright line rule, there are going to be a certain number of would-be claimants or those who would take under but for that rule. For example, drawing an analogy, a rough analogy of Haas, because I'm not that familiar with it, the veteran who was 100 feet offshore versus the veteran who had 2 feet on the sand. Obviously,
was that regulation issued in the face of another statutory provision that says the secretary can take it away when it's excessive or unreasonable? The secretary cannot award Gulf War benefits unless he determines that where the veteran stood was excessive or unreasonable? I mean, that wasn't a limitation that existed in the Haas case. In this case, you have a specific limitation.
As to reasonableness.
The fee must be excessive and unreasonable.
As to reasonableness, Your Honor.
Right.
The secretary would also submit that the regulation as the state's court recognized, there's not a clear line between eligibility and reasonableness, Your Honor. The secretary would submit,
And why did the secretary draw a clean line?
The secretary drew a clean line because, consistent with what Judge Hagel mentioned earlier, prior to the grant of service connection, the nature of the work is generally different. And at some point,
But you have to admit, if the regional office had awarded 100%, the attorney would receive 20% of it. But because the client fired the attorney and the regional office gave 0% and the regional office was wrong and the board approved 100%, the attorney is left out in limbo land?
Well, the starting point here, Your Honor, is it is the veteran's money. Obviously, the attorney through contract may earn that money. But the Congress has created a role for the secretary to play in this regard. The secretary, again, respectfully submits that there is a gap in 5904 as a whole as to what happens when counsel is discharged. Most of 5904 seems to be based on Congress's premise or perhaps assumption.
Well,
let me assume
that he wasn't even discharged. Let's say counsel agreed to represent the veteran at the court for 20% of whatever he gets down below. Is that a legitimate contract? And he says, I'm not going to represent you down below, though. But in the initial RO decision, he got 100%. Would the veteran get 20% of that? I mean, would the counsel get 20% of that?
If there was representation before the court, I believe this court has separate case law that deals specifically with contracts for that are based on representation before the court. So I don't know that I'd... If this were in a vacuum, I don't know.
I mean, I may be wrong, but I thought that I've seen cases where attorney agreed to represent them at court for 20% of an ultimate award down below. Have they not? Without agreeing to represent them down below.
I'm sure that there are cases.
And under this regulation, if the RO awarded 100%, the attorney would get 20% of that, would he not? Even though the attorney did nothing.
Yes, he would, Your Honor.
All right. But if the RO awarded 0% and the board overturned that because the RO was wrong, the attorney would get nothing under this regulation. Is that correct?
Under this regulation, he would. But, Your Honor, in that situation, I don't think the court should minimize the importance of the appeal process. The appeal and the evidence that comes in typically associated with the appeal is what gets the appellant from point, or rather the veteran, from point A to point B. In this case, it's clear. I think the facts of this case are a good example of why the secretary implemented a bright line rule. The facts of this case completely support the secretary's implementation of a bright line rule, because here you have a situation where, again, the secretary is concerned. There are extreme examples. Either the appellant or the appellee could present a parade of horribles, Your Honor, no question. But there are certainly situations where the secretary would be deeply concerned that to increase volume, a hypothetical attorney might very well load up on cases on the front end and then either through withdrawal on his own or being fired, might very well abandon a lot of veterans and still, under appellant's theory, would be able to take the full 20% in every one of those instances. Now, I understand that appellant, in his brief, didn't account for Skates in that regard. But again, Your Honor, to the extent that Skates itself could stand, for the Federal Circuit to have announced the rule that it did in Skates, the Federal Circuit, I would think, first had to have seen that there was a gap or an ambiguity that Congress hadn't answered, and two, the Federal Circuit addressed it. Now, I mean,
if we're talking about whether Skates applies, that's a whole other issue. As I understand the issue before the court, primary issue before the court is that the board applied this regulation and said that counsel, because of this regulation, not because of an equity determination under Skates, but because of this regulation, was not entitled to anything further than what was awarded on the initial RO decision. So the question is this regulation permissible given the statutory provisions that we mentioned earlier?
Your Honor, my use of Skates was actually to address this question and not the question that Judge Hagel had presented in his supplemental memorandum order. My reasoning, Your Honor, is this. The Federal Circuit did not believe that the statutory system spoke to these sorts of issues. And Your
these
Honor,
sorts being what?
Well, in the
Skates, I thought it was when the counsel got
in the Skates case, it was simply where counsel withdrew generally. In this case, which implicates the regulation, it's where counsel was discharged prior to the initiation of the appeal. And the Secretary, again, has drawn a bright line. And looking at what the Supreme Court's reasoning in Chevron, again, the court, it's not a case where the court necessarily has to appreciate or endorse the line or the choice that the Secretary has made. It's that the court doesn't find that the statute prohibits it outright. That may be a slight oversimplification, but I think that's a reasonable interpretation of Chevron analysis.
Well, Counselor, make sure that I'm tracking here everyone's arguments.
Yes, Your Honor.
What we're really deciding to apply or not to apply is the 20% automatic payment to the attorney, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's correct.
And so if Mr. Lippman is dissatisfied with the results obtained here today, or if Mr. Swinger is, they have the right to go into a civil court that's set up to do contractual disputes and litigate this matter, do they not?
Yes, Your Honor. I think, you know, there's withholding or otherwise. I think there are often instances where counsel will sue their client in state court.
So the touchstone question is whether or not we had an enforceable contract, number one. That is to say, the contingency fee agreement that was drafted by Mr. Lippman, which provides for withdrawal of the veteran if he chooses to discharge Mr. Lippman, which the veteran claims that he did. And you have Mr. Lippman's position, which was he didn't discharge me properly, or I didn't mean that in the terms of the underlying agreement. But the point I'm trying to make quite simply is this, that what we're all arguing about is the automatic assignment of 20% of the claim or the benefits arrived at by the veteran, Mr. Swinger, or not. If this were a contract for 22% or 25% or 30% of the overall claim, the Secretary would say, you're not entitled to the automatic 20% check. That's between you and your client. Is that correct?
That's correct. The Secretary would not be the collection agent, so to speak.
So basically, the Secretary is a stakeholder. Somebody's going to claim the $7,500, whether it's Mr. Lippman or the veteran. The Secretary's got the money and basically saying, I really don't care, but somebody is entitled to this money. So maybe somebody ought to interplead it into a court that's set up for purposes of contractual disputes or to a bar association. Just a suggestion.
Your Honor, I think Congress would have to enact that kind of...
Well, give it some thought, but it seems to me that we're putting the taxpayer in the middle of this, and it's not a fight between the taxpayer and anybody. It's who gets the $7,500, the veteran or Mr. Lippman. And it seems to me that rather than put the taxpayer through all of this in terms of the administrative costs of all of us, that somebody ought to consider a system maybe a little bit more efficient.
Another point I think that is related to that, Your Honor, is I suppose if the court found that the contract didn't cover that period or was invalid, it may very well moot out the regulatory challenge that appellant has put forward. Of course, the Secretary has no way to or no role to predict what the court might do, but that would seem to be also another possibility.
What? If the contract was for a contingency fee of 25%, what would happen then?
If the fee were for 25%,
all other facts being equal,
the The regulation, Your Honor, would still apply. The secretary would not withhold the money. The money would be paid directly to the veteran. But the secretary, through Congress and through regulation, still has a say, as does this court, in, as to the reasonableness, but also as to whether there can be question as to eligibility as well, Your Honor.
So in that case, if I understand you correctly, So in this case, what would happen is exactly the same thing. The secretary would take a look at this and say, well, look, the regulation says he represented him up until he gets his first award on remand, and we're going to take 25% of that. Or would that, how would that mechanically work? I'm sorry, I'm not just understanding you.
With your leave, Your Honors, can I just clarify that point?
Sure.
With my co-counsel? Your Honor, in that situation, if one of the parties were to complain, it would put both eligibility and reasonableness before the agency, and so the agency would adjudicate that, much like the case that's before the court today.
But what would the agency do initially? I mean, you know, they're going to initially give the award out, right? I mean, they're going to adjudicate 30%, let's say, and now they've got, you know, a retroactive award to give to somebody. How would they distribute that?
It's over anything over 20%. That particular contract is not eligible for withholding by the secretary.
I understand.
So that money would go
directly to the veteran.
It would go directly to the veteran.
And then it would be between the client and the veteran. It would be up to the attorney to collect his 25% or whatever portion of that.
The parties could bring the government and the court into that question, however, Your
if
Honor.
They did it before the money was paid?
No, Your Honor. Through an NOD, they could challenge eligibility and reasonableness. And I think this is part of Judge Lance's concern that, you know, in all these circumstances, yes, the government would be drawn into it, and the court would be, you know, potentially drawn into it as well. Your Honors, going back to reasonableness, because I don't believe I've persuaded the entire court on that issue.
You can't always tell just by looking at us.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I would like to narrow this down again. The board decided, based on this regulation, that Mr. Lipman was not entitled to any additional attorney's fees.
I don't believe there's any other way to read the BVA decision.
All right. So the issue is this regulation permissible or not? If this regulation is permissible, fine. If it's not permissible, then we go to the second phase, which is presumably Skates, although we haven't the latest argument that maybe Skates doesn't apply. But for our purposes here.
I think, Your Honor, again, Skates could still be could have been applicable in this case as to the first pot of money.
I understand.
But the veteran in this case didn't pursue that.
Right. But because of this regulation, it's not applicable to the second pot of money.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the issue is this regulation.
The issue is this regulation, and that's what appellant has brought before the court.
Right.
And again, Your Honors, respectfully, you know, to the Secretary's mind, appellant did not put a lot before the court as to that issue. The secretary understands that the court clearly has jurisdiction over this matter, and the court has a lot of discretion as to what it would do. But the secretary, again, repeats his plea that where a duly promulgated regulation is, where the court may contemplate overturning a duly promulgated regulation, that perhaps it hold those challenging it to a slightly higher standard.
Well, would that be arbitrary and capricious?
No, Your Honor. I mean as to pleading. I'm making a reference to the Secretary's citation to Coker, among other things. Arbitrary and capricious is certainly the standard of review that the court would employ to determine whether or not the Secretary's regulation.
Well, certainly given the supplemental briefing which this court did ask for, brought this issue to fore, did it not?
It did, Your Honor.
All right.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it. I think the supplemental memo is actually discrete from the from this issue. The supplemental memo basically requested that the parties or required that the parties explain the interplay between skates and the regulation because, you know, on their face, they seem to do very similar things. And so the.
Well, let me put it this way. In the initial briefing, the issue was raised as to whether or not this regulation could stand and face the statute, was it not?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. The Secretary's only point is the sufficiency of the challenge.
Okay.
Your Honors, the point that the intervener made, and we don't represent the intervener, but I think it's if should somehow the court determine that that the reg were invalid, or if it applied quantum merit, I think appellant has before you today indicated that he didn't participate in the later phases of the claim. So in any event, the Secretary would ask that.
What about appellant's position that it's an entire claim? Now, we do have processes down below that go up and down, that he was willing to represent this veteran through the entire process, that the veteran, as the counsel is telling us today, let him go for not any valid reason in his view, and proceeded to represent himself. And as I understand, counsel's making a differentiation in skates that there were two counsel there, so the veteran wasn't going to benefit, so that can't be the reason why he did it. But in this case, it very well may be the reason why he did it. And so wouldn't that, if this were to be remanded, if we did go those routes, wouldn't that just be an issue that the board would look at?
Your Honor,
there
weren't two counsel in skates.
No, I know, that's my point.
And there weren't two counsel in this case. The skates claimant was obviously similarly situated in that, you know, I guess the Secretary has a problem, Your Honor, with the kind of this insinuation that veterans are likely to game the system. That's not the Secretary's view. The Secretary, in writing this regulation and balancing the Congress's interest in having attorneys provide representation and protecting veterans, you know, made a balancing question there as far as where the Secretary thought the line should be drawn and did, in fact, choose to draw a line. But the Secretary would respectfully submit, I don't want to go get off your question, Your Honor.
You're doing fine.
But the Secretary would respectfully submit that just as the judiciary at skates found that there was room to announce a rule, I think it would be fair to say that if the Secretary had enacted a regulation that said the same thing that skates said,
which was what?
That quantum merit analysis would apply where there's a firing. There'd be no question that, one, there's a gap in the statutory section, and two, that, well, the Federal Circuit's already said it, so presumably it's a reasonable.
But the Secretary quantum merit takes in all, the entire totality of the circumstances.
But the Secretary doesn't believe we're very far removed from what the skates court did in the regulation. Now, the court could disagree. The court could say it would be the court's preference that the Secretary had allowed for a broader consideration a la quantum merit. But what the Secretary did is really not too different, Your Honor. And this is I think, part of you know, Chevron's caution to courts about the role of the judiciary versus the role of the executive branch. And again, Your Honor, I will assume from questions, perhaps incorrectly, that there might be some disagreement from the court as to how the Secretary drafted his regulation. But again, in light of what the court and Skates did and how this is so akin to it. And it happens to be line drawing, but line drawing is frequently the best policy, factoring in efficiency, predictability, costs, those sorts of factors, that the Secretary would respectfully submit that, you know, this was reasonable. It would certainly pass the highly deferential, arbitrary, and capricious standard of review.
What would happen if the attorney was discharged after he filed the initial brief, before he filed a reply brief, for example, and the veteran himself wrote the reply brief out, and then we went forward and the veteran won?
Is this before a court, Your Honor,
right,
as opposed to the agency?
Yeah, before the court. And there was a remand, just like here, and he got service connection, and he was given an initial rating. But he was fired before the decision of the court.
I think, Your Honor, that, again, my recollection is I think the court has looked agreeably upon contracts that call for awards pursuant to strictly for representation before the court. So it wouldn't I don't think that case would implicate the Secretary's regulation. Now, that falls before the line that the Secretary has drawn. That would involve the first pot of money, and therefore Skates quantum merit or the Secretary's regulation as to the factors of reasonableness would certainly, to my mind, apply in that situation.
Now, as I, interpret the questions from Judge Castle and the argument of the appellant here, is, and tell me if you agree with this, that the portions of the statute providing for the Secretary to determine the reasonableness of fees should govern, and that the regulation that we're talking about unduly restricts that discretion that the Secretary has by drawing this bright line. Would you agree that that's the argument that they're making, that the appellant's making?
I don't know that I'd necessarily read that from appellant's brief, but yes, the court has certainly placed that issue before the parties today, I think.
Okay. Now, doing the Chevron analysis, which you started out.
Yes, sir.
In Chevron, it says, if the if the statute's ambiguous, the Secretary can plug the hole, issue a regulation that interprets the portion of the statute that's ambiguous, correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, do you agree that the statute is ambiguous?
I believe the statute has, as the Chevron Court also acknowledged it, I believe the statute has a gap.
Okay. And the Secretary filled it, but the Secretary can only fill it by a regulation that doesn't conflict with the statute, correct?
Secretary can never conflict with the statute, Your Honor, but the Secretary would suggest that the gap is perhaps broader than the court is suggesting or in this question. The Secretary sees, Chevron talked about how Congress will oftentimes consciously or unconsciously leave a specific question out. This is a more narrow question. This is a question where there's termination or perhaps voluntary termination or involuntary termination of an attorney's services.
But I don't think that take that out of the equation. Okay, I mean, in this sense, I'm just talking about the statute and the regulation, right? You got a statute that says commits to the Secretary in the situation of an attorney fee to determine whether a fee charged to a veteran is reasonable. I mean, that's what the statute says. Then you have a regulation that draws this bright line and says, in this instance, you don't have to determine if it's reasonable because we've drawn this bright line. In other words, the Secretary doesn't have to exercise the Secretary's discretion in that regard. Now, why is that not in conflict with the statute?
I don't think it's conflict in part because of what Skates tells us, that these are not necessarily clearly reasonableness determinations. These can be you know, it can be a little bit cloudy as to whether it's reasonableness or eligibility. And that being the case, and I see I'm about out of time, Your Honors, if you'd prefer me to conclude.
If you don't mind.
No, no, please. Answer your question. We need additional time, and we'll get equivalent.
Thank you, Your Honor. And because of Skate's recognition that this sort of question is not clear in that regard, it's different than simply the reasonableness statutory subsection, Your Honor. It's a different question than what Congress answered. And Skate's itself has framed it that way. And that would be the Secretary's position as to that question. If the court would allow me to simply sum up, the Secretary respectfully submits that the court should affirm the June 11, 2007 BVA decision and not overturn the Secretary's duly promulgated regulation. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Lippman, you have 7 minutes.
Yeah, I just want to sort of take issue with the Secretary on a few points. One is that the Chevron states that if the language is clear in the statute, there is no deference that's entitled to the reg. It just doesn't apply. The statute speaks in terms of on the basis of the claim. And even the...
Take me to that site again.
The Chevron site?
No, the statute provision that says on the basis of the claim.
5904D2, when a claimant and an agent or attorney have entered into a fee agreement described in paragraph 2, the total fee payable to the agent or attorney may not exceed 20% of the total amount of any past due benefits awarded on the basis of the claim.
Okay.
Congress knows the language, and for one thing else, that even the Secretary has defined what claims are. A claim is a unitary concept. It's not divided into phases.
But all that says is it can't exceed 20%.
Right, under that statute, right, on the basis, right.
So you don't get the Secretary reduce it?
It could reduce it if they rebut the presumption of reasonableness.
Where is the presumption of reasonableness?
I think it's in the language. It's in the reg, Your Honor, and I think it's read. I think it's a fair reading of 5904C3A, where it says that if the Secretary finds that the fee is excessive or unreasonable, so I just think that inheres. And let's look at just Skate's for just a little minute here. It says. And I read from...
Can I just first refer you to 5904A5? Isn't there a presumption that it's reasonable if it doesn't exceed 20%?
Yes, Ron, I can see that. Thank you.
All right. Proceed.
It says, we can conclude that implicit in this arrangement was the understanding that Mason's right to receive the full 20% of past due benefits would arise only if Mason continued as Skate's attorney until the case was successfully completed. If, as here, the veteran terminated the lawyer's services during the case and retained a substitute representative, the first lawyer's fees will be based upon and fairly reflect the lawyer's contribution to the case. I think when it says the first, there was only one lawyer. I think it's confusing because they're drawing from civil cases, and the presumption is that the successor will be an attorney. And so I think that comes in. I also asked the court to look at the Frakas case, 494 Pacific 2nd, 9, pages 13 through 14. And again, it talks about the self-limiting factor, that if you have a successor representative being a paid representative, an attorney, that operates to avoid abuse. And that's so important.
Well, Mr. Lippman, I... Going back to your hypothesis there, so your position is that once one of your clients or former clients signs a contingency fee agreement with you, that they owe you money on anything that happens thereafter on their claim for disability unless they have an attorney substitute in for you.
Well, unless there's I'm entitled to the presumption of reasonableness. And I don't think that the statute of regulation makes a distinction.
It's only a presumption that's going to apply if you had an extant contract, an enforceable contract in existence. That's the question. If your client says, I hereby terminate your services, thank you very much for what you've done, here's your $9,100. I'm taking it on my own from here on out.
But
you don't have a contract. If you don't have a contract, you don't have a claim, and if you don't have a claim, I'm not sure where the $7,500 is supposed to come from.
My understanding is that the contract continues. That simply because he dismissed me, he doesn't have to. When we entered into the
contract. How would a client of yours terminate a contract under your theory? He just doesn't want you handling the case any longer.
Right.
It happens. All right?
Right.
And you're saying unless or until he runs in a substitute attorney, You're not going to let him go. You're not going to let him terminate the contract. Something's wrong with this problem. The other thing I want you to think about a little bit is, if we give the veteran, Mr. Swinger's $7,500 away and give it to you, he's out $7,500, right? On the other hand, if you're dissatisfied with the judgment of this court and the board, it seems to me you still have a cause of action if you choose to pursue it against your former client, Mr. Swinger, in a court of law, a civil court of law. You can go sue him someplace if you want to.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I don't guess because I think it might be collateral estoppel.
I'm not saying it's a good lawsuit. I'm just saying, you know.
Well, I'm not sure if this has any life to it. I guess what I'm saying is, and, you know, one of the things is that I don't believe, I think in the contract there's bargains, that it's governed by the statute, but there's also a contractual part to this. And I think that...
Exactly. That's my point.
Okay. But he bargained for continuous representation throughout the case. I bargained for the 20% on the claim.
Ah, but you wrote the contract that said you can withdraw at any time. You can discharge the attorney at any time.
Yeah, I didn't say that. It's contractual obligations. He can...
What now? Say that again?
I would agree with you. If I said I'm leaving, and if I was the one that to terminate the contract without cause... then I would forfeit.
Okay.
Okay, but if he terminates me, he bargained for continuous representation. He's free to let that go, and I don't think the contract says otherwise. But there's nowhere that I think he can imply that he's not going to be obligated on the fees. I just, personally, my interpretation.
So you're saying that the language that you wrote that says the client may discharge the attorney at any time, period.
He's unhappy. Yeah,
doesn't mean that he gets off without paying you. He could just fire you, and you still get paid.
Yeah, he's not forced. I mean, I think that's just stating the law. Isn't that the law? I mean,
doesn't that terminate the contract if he discharges you?
Not according to me. No, it terminates my representation, and he's free to do that.
But you're
he's not a prisoner. He's not a prisoner with. Yeah.
But you're saying only if he gets another attorney substituted in, are you going to recognize?
Add another minute to the clock to equal this out.
Only that then the presumption of reasonableness applies only to 20% collectively. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And that's because of policy that's read in. Yes. Anyway, I think just as claims, if you look at the Secretary's own regulation, Section 3.160, it defines status of claims. And it separately defines a pending claim, a finally adjudicated claim. I mean, these concepts are well-defined, and Congress knows it. If Congress wanted to break it up into phases of a claim, it knew how to do so and didn't. So I think that the Secretary is creating an ambiguity where an ambiguity does not exist.
I have a question. Only one more question for you, Mr. Lippman. Why is it that the court had to notify your former client that he had rights as an intervener? Why didn't you see that your client was served with the board decision when you're here advocating a position adverse to your client?
It was probably an oversight, Your Honor. I apologize. I mean, it's a little.
Don't you see that that you two have a conflicting position?
Yeah.
On
yeah.
your feet.
Yeah, we do. Okay. I mean, it wasn't intentional. If there's no other...
That will be it. Thank you very much. The case will be submitted, and we will greet counsel.
This honorable court is adjourned to further order.